Hello, I'm Michael Fletcher, co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. How are you doing, Dr. Patterson?
I think that's fine, thank you. Nice to be able to speak with you after writing about you.
Indeed. Good to have you on the phone. And, you know, obviously as a reader of the book, you know kind of what we tried to do with Clarence Thomas. We tried to write a book, Kevin Merritt and my co-author and myself, sort of explaining how it is Clarence Thomas became the man he became and came to adopt the kind of conservative legal philosophy and conservative philosophy generally that characterizes his work on the Supreme Court, and even before that when he worked in the federal government both for Reagan and briefly for President Bush. And to do this, we sort of went back and traced his life back to his beginnings in Pinpoint, Georgia, and later in more significantly in Savannah, Georgia, where he was essentially formed under the tutelage of his grandfather. Mm-hmm. You know, and from there, you know, Clarence Thomas went on to junior seminary. It was his grandfather's dream that he become the first black priest in Savannah, and that wasn't to be. He went to junior seminary, actually went on to a major seminary in Missouri, where he dropped out after his first year as a result of some racial bias, some you know, outright prejudice that he encountered. And that's something people don't know about Clarence Thomas. They don't understand kind of the racial sensitivity and the kind of racial awareness that's characterized him for his entire life. You know, and after dropping out of the seminary, Clarence Thomas was steered to the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. A former chemistry teacher got him to go there. And from Holy Cross, he went to Yale Law School. And from Yale Law School, he ended up working for John Danforth, who was then Attorney General in Missouri, later went on to become a U.S. Senator and brought Clarence Thomas to Washington. And from there, he went to the Reagan and Bush administrations. There's just a quick capsule, and then we can, you know, discuss.
I was fascinated with your attempt at trying to understand this incredibly complicated, tortured person. And, you know, there are many positive aspects of the book which I emphasized in my review. There are some things which I'd like to talk to you about. I mean, you don't want to hear once again what I liked about the book. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe we could talk about some of the things which one just couldn't say because there's a space constraint on reviews. As a journalist, you know only too well.
Oh, yeah, I know all about that.
One thing which I was a little, I wish I had more time to discuss was in the very fine first, very good first section, I thought they did an excellent job probing his early life. But you describe it as a Republican myth. The idea that the Republican myth being that here's a compelling story of someone who came up from the bottom and you know, had a remarkable life in which he overcame sort of just tremendous odds, and you designated a Republican myth. But you know, reading the very excellent account you gave, I didn't think that was a myth at all. I mean, your portrait of that little place where he was born was one of the most depressing things I've read. I mean, it's hard to believe that there are places like that in modern America. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in which, as I noted, the high point of economic life is working in this crop picking factory.
Right, Barnes.
That was grim. That was bleak. And it therefore makes it all the more remarkable that he, even before he left there at the age of six, that he was already on the path of reading and so on. And I found that compelling. So I didn't think it was a myth. And even going to Savannah, it wasn't much better, I mean, for a while, until the grandparents came around, you know. So given I have a young daughter, she's just three, and I can't help thinking how important those first 5-6 years are in a person's life. And my God, I mean, you know, it couldn't have been worse. And so I wondered why you say that that's a Republican myth. It is compelling, and I mean, and understanding how he was able to, at such an early age, sort of, you know, in a way, I already begin to escape it through books. I thought it was a very compelling story.
No, I hear your point. And I think, I don't think it was our intention to say that his story wasn't compelling. I think our point was that in the sort of the myth-making that goes on with, you know, surrounding these big appointments now in Washington, they maybe overstated the case and tried to make the case to be even more dramatic than it actually is in real life. As you point out, I mean, I'm the father of two children, you know, a daughter who's now going to be a senior in college and a son's a senior in high school. And, gosh, I know their trajectory started, as you point out, at the age of really at birth and reading to them in the crib and,
right,
you know, all
right,
the things that, you know, middle-class parents tend to do with kids or are more likely to do with children. And
yeah,
clearly Clarence Thomas is self-motivated. He's a guy who had a natural affinity for learning and for had the discipline to sit down and read, and basically on his own because his environment wasn't conducive to that in the early years. But nonetheless, when he moved to Savannah, his grandfather was kind of a pillar of the community, and it wasn't really discussed in that way during the confirmation process.
Right.
His grandfather was a self-made man, to be sure, and is an undereducated man. I believe he had a third-grade education.
Right.
But this is a gentleman who managed to build a very successful ice delivery, wood delivery, and later fuel oil delivery business, and had rental properties, and was one of the, you know, one of the bigger black businessmen in Savannah. And I don't think it was discussed that way during the confirmation process.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of the term myth, I think it's woven in there. You know, Clarence Thomas had opportunity to go to Catholic schools in Savannah, which bolstered that sort of early curiosity for learning. And those schools, while segregated, were far superior to the segregated public schools. So Clarence Thomas had some advantages. It's funny,
yeah,
in going to report, you know, and Pinpoint was one of the first reporting visits we made. We ended up going down there two or three times during the book.
Yes.
I had heard the story, and I expected Clarence Thomas's sort of profile to be a little bit different among his friends. You know, I expected this was the kid who came to school in tattered clothing, or, you know, had the pants,
yes,
that didn't quite reach the shoes and all of that. And instead, at least the people we reached, and we talked to a number of people who went to elementary,
mm-hmm,
and high school with him before he switched to seminary, and they said they were kind of curious at the characterization during the hearings themselves. They knew Clarence, and Clarence was a kid who would go to the candy store, had money in his pocket, certainly worked hard, and certainly was driven by his grandfather,
right, right,
but was a kid who wasn't
right,
out of the mainstream. You know, he was a kid who had,
right,
I mean, not to say advantages, but he was a kid like any other.
Right. Let's talk about that, a kid like any other, because one of the little areas where, I wouldn't call it disagreement, but I had a different emphasis from the one you gave, is that among the things which he claims, among the trials of growing up, and I believe what you said, I mean, that, you know, his economic situation was certainly not as bad as it made out, but among the trials of growing up is this, and I think it really took me by surprise, the internal color thing, the prejudice from lighter-skinned blacks and so on. And you had a long quotation there about him saying, you know, his color, his hair, his the way he looked and so on. And I was taken aback at first, but then as I thought about it, I mean, you expressed some skepticism about how much of a scarring experience that was. Thomas seemed to think that was a bad experience. And the reason why I should explain, I could relate it to someone, is that I come from a part of the world, the Caribbean, where this is still rampant. And
mm-hmm.
not as bad as it used to be, but certainly far more so than it is among black Americans now, who is one of the things which the civil rights movement and the black identity movement and black pride has overcome to some extent. Not entirely. It is still a fact. I mean, the sociologists have demonstrated that being lighter skinned does carry advantages still.
Okay.
But that experience is one which I know of, thinking growing up in at a time when it was still rampant, and it was very painful. And I wondered whether you were not perhaps more skeptical of Thomas's claim than you should have been. I mean, you accepted the view of fellow blacks at a time that was more class than color. But you know, that sort of thing cuts deeply.
Yeah, and I think you're right about that. And I guess the point we're trying to make is that this is something that Clarence Thomas continues to talk about today. And when you go back and talk to his friends, he grew up with it. And again, you know, you and I can have the same experience and come out of it totally differently.
Right.
I can be scarred and you not. Just, I could just be a little more impervious or whatever. You know, I just have a different kind of sensibility about
it. Yes.
And I don't mean to deny that it was, you know, that it was a cutting experience for him. But his friends, again, were curious. I remember talking to one gentleman, Dennis Cooper, to get his first name as I sit here. And he said, you know, he kind of put it in this frame, like, you know, when we're kids, people get teased about, somebody gets teased about something, you know, whatever it is, you know, if you couldn't dance, if you, you know, you played basketball a funny way, if you, you know what I mean, if you, you wore high water pants, as we used to say when I was a kid growing up in New York, you know, so you always, so everyone had a cross to bear, and this particular guy, it's not a particularly bad cross, but when you're a kid, it's interesting. He was the son of a dentist, which was highly unusual in the African-American community, and he was Dr. Cooper's boy, and what that meant, really implicit in that was you're a punk, you know, you're soft, you're privileged in a way, you're a spoiled brat. I mean, that's what people were saying. And he said it's something that used to bother him when he was young, but as he grew older, he grew some, you know, he developed some perspective about it. And the thing that's striking about Justice Thomas is that, you know, a lot of his frame even now, at least what we were able to pick up about his conversations with people who come visit him at the Supreme Court and elsewhere, still gets kind of put into that frame. It's not so much the kind of thing we chuckle at now. I chuckle now that someone thought. I remember I used to have a paper route when I was a little boy, and you know, I remember being 10 years old and lying. You know, you had to be 12, and I got this paper route, and I was always just this little, you know, whatever, you know, and you know, this little guy doing his paper route and going to collect my money, and people thought, you know, some kind of goody two shoes. And when you're a kid, it's kind of an awkward situation, you know. And but you learn when you get older to sort of push that aside, and with Justice Thomas is still part of his psyche, I think.
Right. My sense is that it ran deeper than these kind of slights which we all have as children, you know, whether you're a nerd or so on. I mean, these are things you overcome, and you just got to be make some money, and being a nerd is behind you. I do recall, he mentioned this thing about ABC. I've never heard that about America's Blackest Child in the Caribbean. It was, people would call it 11:59.
1 minute before midnight, huh?
Or Captain Midnight, you know, and it cuts deeply. Anyway, but of course, the fact that he still talks about it indicates that, you know, it is something which he found deeply troubling, and it certainly is one of the things to explain some of his, the many, many contradictions which you brought out. And there's some more details which we'll get into later on. But there's one thing I'm curious about, and that is, was he embraced by the right, or did he go out seeking the right? There was a transition there which was crucial. Somewhere, I guess, after Yale, and I mean, the book, did get into this, but I would have liked it to you to expand more on this. How, was it an embrace? Well, I guess to some extent it was both, but which was the more important one? Because there's someone I know who actually was a friend of Thomas once, but or thought he was, and they're no longer the case. I mean, that's Glenn Lowry. You mentioned him in the book.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Now, Glenn was a case, it seemed to me, where he was embraced, and he took the bait and really went a long way in that direction until he pulled back. What exactly happened, if you could go into more detail in your sense with Thomas? Did he sort of just sit down and say, you know, the way to do it is to become a black conservative, I'm going to go after this? Because given his background, given the painful experience of racism, which was more than normal, it seems to me, what do you think was going on there?
I think he kind of sort of haltingly moved to the right and then was embraced. You know, I think he, for a long time, he was a guy, kind of in search of a philosophy. You mentioned when he got out of Yale, he went to work for Danforth, who was very much a moderate Republican.
That's right.
Worked for him in the Attorney General's office in Missouri, ended up following Danforth back to Washington. But there were some important people who came into Thomas's life along the way, and one was Thomas Sowell, the black economist.
I'm sure
you know him well.
Yes.
And he's out at Stanford at the Hoover Institution now. And as you know from reading his columns, and I'm sure you've read some of his books, he kind of is very much a conservative, I mean, to sort of use that word broadly. And Thomas discovered his work, actually had been introduced to Sowell's work in, when he was at Yale, and actually was so steeped in kind of a liberal orthodoxy that he threw the book in the trash can, as Thomas tells the story. And later encountered another of Sowell's books while he was working for Danforth, and found it compelling. It's like pouring water, drinking water in the desert. He just soaked it up. And actually went so far as to drive from Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri, to St. Louis, where Sowell was having a debate with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the future Supreme Court Justice, interestingly enough, and sort of, introduced himself to Sowell, and that actually initiated a friendship that continues today. And I think in many ways, Sowell was able to frame a lot of the notions that were inside of Clarence Thomas. I mean, you take certain things that he would call liberal orthodoxy. You have the case the other day on school desegregation.
Right.
Yeah, back in the 70s, everybody said, you have to integrate schools. This is the final step, to implement Brown going back to the 50s. Two decades later, we still haven't integrated. We need to do that. Busing plans were all the rage. They were being resisted all over the place.
Right.
And Clarence Thomas was one of those people who kind of felt inside, why do black students need to sit next to white students to do well in school?
Right. I want to get back. I'd like to get back to that a little later, because it's very much in the news now. But to get back to Sowell, there is one of the things which it's a powerful insight into the man, it is still a problem trying to figure out how he reconciles the awful lack of compassion exhibited in some of the rulings, the most famous, notorious case being the one concerning what constitutes cruel and inhuman punishment. How he reconciles that with his personal life, in which he seems to go out of his way to be a friendly, even compassionate person. I still remain puzzled by that. I mean, what is that? Is he addressing, does he feel he has a debt to pay or something to prove by taking this extreme and at times callous position? I remember that I distinctly remember the New York Times editorial after that decision, in which they described it as the cruelest justice.
Right.
I mean, what's your view about how he reconciles that almost callous sort of attitude, often having consequences for black folks, with what you also describe as a man who, in his personal life, seems to be quite a sort of friendly and even sometimes compassionate person. That's all almost schizophrenic, and I wonder whether you had any more insights than that, because I felt there's something missing there. How does he reconcile these two?
I know, Dr. Patterson, you put your finger on a question I'd love to ask Justice Thomas. That's one of the disadvantages we had in not being able to interview him, because he wouldn't sit for an interview.
Yeah.
And my take, judging from, reading his rulings and, listening to his speeches and his testimony in various venues, is that, he draws this kind of bright line between his jurisprudence and his life.
Uh-huh.
And his jurisprudence, he would say, is a product of this pure kind of process of originalist thinking. He looks at every legal case kind of through this originalist lens. And his only question really is, what did the Constitution, what was envisioned at the time this article was written in the Constitution? And in the case of the Eighth Amendment, he said, well, you know what? It wasn't, it didn't matter, what happened to someone once they were jailed. It wasn't a constitutional issue. It could be a legal issue still, but it's not a constitutional issue. the only thing that the Constitution sort of envisions or tries to regulate or tries to create a framework for here is the sentences imposed on prisoners. But once a prisoner is in jail, if the prison guards shackle him and beat him, that's a bad thing, that's an inhuman thing, that's a cruel thing, but it's not cruel and unusual punishment. Yeah. So I think it gets back to kind of his judicial philosophy there.
Right, and it's a pity that this rational, purely sort of detached perspective always somehow ends up with an extremely right-wing opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you named the issue, and that's something, we say in the book, and I know one of your critiques, and it's one, taken well, because we probably didn't spend enough time on sort of delving into kind of like his judicial philosophy in that way. We tried to talk about the bottom line of his philosophy and what it means for, school integration, what it means for affirmative action, what it means for the imposition of the death penalty. And we say in passing in the chapter where we compare him to Scalia, we talk about, how the two men share the same judicial philosophy. Right. But I think this originalism, but, in a way, it's... it's a tricky thing because it's discussed in such a dispassionate way, as if this roadmap will lead us anywhere. But as you point out, conservatives love it because it almost always leads to a conservative outcome. Maybe the only area I can think of where it may not be a quote unquote conservative outcome would be in the area of the First Amendment.
That's from as you know, it's many of the legal readers would have wanted more on that. And in that regard, several people wrote me angrily in response to the review. One of them claiming that I'm a racist because I hinted that that he was possibly influenced by Scalia, and that, he's an independent thinker, and that if anything, he is influencing Scalia as often as the other way around, and that it is because he's black that I don't know whether they thought I wasn't. I got at least four letters in which I was called a racist, first time in my many years in America. But obviously people feel very strongly that he has an original legal mind. It took me by surprise, and in fact, in preparing for a review of the book, I did go read some of the stuff, because I'd been generally of the view that, this man was not an especially distinguished legal scholar, but lo and behold, there are a couple of books which claim that his opinions are deserving of respect, as I said, among lawyers anyway.
Sure.
One of which has to do with his originalist philosophy and the fact that he seems to represent the purest of the pure in this tradition now, which is why he's so beloved by conservatives.
Right, that's a point that even Antonin Scalia makes, and we make the point in the book. If you read particularly Justice Thomas's concurrences and dissents, he's willing to go much farther than any other justice. He's clearly the most conservative justice on the court. And Scalia himself says that he, Scalia, has more regard and more respect for precedent than does Clarence Thomas. Scalia says he's a little aware that, society has made certain assumptions and built entire institutions on the rule of law, and we can't just pull the carpet out now. And Thomas's view is, so what? If you made a mistake, as he would put it, if a mistake was made 100 years ago, we need to go back and correct it, regardless of the ramifications for our society, which is a very radical view, actually.
That is extraordinary. And how did he get to such a place? Because there are different levels of conservatism. And indeed, as I pointed out in the upfront interview, I think it's a good idea. It's a good thing that you have moderate conservative blacks. They're not viewed as a homogeneous group with just one agenda. And quite frankly, I was fooled by the man, because I thought that is where he was more or less located back during the hearings, that, right of center. But how on earth did he get way over there? What was pushing him over there? This is what remains a puzzle, and I guess it's a puzzle to you.
It's a bit of a puzzle, and I think he's become clearly more conservative through the years. During the middle of his tenure before going to the court, during the middle of his tenure on the EEOC, you know, we interviewed civil rights types around Washington who said that, you know, Thomas would have them into their offices. These are NAACP, Legal Defense Fund type people, leadership conference on civil rights, and Thomas would be in dialogue with them. And they said you can see Thomas really wrestling with some of these ideas. I mean, he's looking for kind of a intellectual underpinning, like how is affirmative action, how do you reconcile that with the 14th Amendment in his view? I mean, he was really kind of grappling, reaching, but then there was a point, they said, in the late 80s or toward the end of his EEOC tenure where all of that ended, he seemed to become more ambitious. And I think the theory we put out in the book is that the confirmation process left him with no friends after the other than on the far right. You know, after Anita Hill's allegations and the nightmare that Clarence Thomas lived through in the confirmation hearings, he was left a few friends. Remember, when he first became a justice, there'd be an invitation for him to speak somewhere, and there'd be protests immediately. Even now, he still gets protests. And the only people who would really have him and treat him like a hero and embrace him warmly were people on the extreme right. That's where he finds love now. Right. It's interesting. A friend of his put it that way. You know, like, yeah. You know, who are you going to go to? People who reject you or those who have their arms open to embrace you?
Right. One still on the legal side of things, there's one mystery which I guess you guys weren't able to solve, and that's his silence on the bench. And this cockeyed story he has about, you know, I mean, his Geechee accent it obviously makes no sense because, as you pointed out in the book, I mean, he's a very effective public speaker and a good conversationalist. So, I mean, this is a big mystery. I mean, what's going on? Is it maybe something as simple as the fact that he's just not well prepared? And he's leaving a lot of this to his law clerks, and or what? Do you have any insight in that?
He has to be prepared. It's funny, we interviewed several, I mean, many of his former law clerks who said, you know, he'll go to oral argument, and if nothing else, the law clerks have prepared questions. Because they thoroughly know these cases by the time oral arguments come up. And Thomas is armed with questions, and clearly, as you said, is a well-spoken man. But also, one law clerk did say this, that Clarence Thomas isn't very good in that kind of rapid-fire situation that kind of characterizes oral argument. You know, it's funny, my co-author Kevin made a sort of a good analogy. It's sort of like a journalist. You can be an excellent journalist, but not be good on Meet the Press. And the feeling is that Clarence Thomas, perhaps in that rapid-fire back and forth, is just not as quick on his feet as some of the others with the quick jab and all of that. And a lot of what goes on for oral argument, as you know, is not really so much, even though they're asking questions of the lawyers, the advocates, really they're making points to one another on the bench. You know, that's what oral argument's all about. The justices talk to one another through the advocates. And apparently Thomas isn't that great. And you know, there's something else, just a basic personality trait. Many of his friends say he's the most stubborn person they know. And the more people make an issue of his silence at oral argument, the less likely is Clarence Thomas is to speak. It's that simple.
Yeah. Let's talk about his views on integration, because that's another big mystery here. And that's perhaps one of the biggest contradictions. I mean, a week and a half ago, he joined forcefully in what may be one of the most important opinions of the court undercutting the drive to integration. Mm-hmm. And his position, he sounded, I mean, like a militant chauvinist. This thing about, you know, we don't need to sit next to white mm-hmm. kids in order to learn and so on. Actually, the last time I heard that phrase was when Glenn Lowry wrote an op-ed piece making exactly the same point. And I told Laura then exactly what I thought about that, because and the whole issue of integration is one which Black Americans will have to really become more articulate about, to use the final term. But I mean, Thomas takes this position, but he's married to a very white woman. I mean, I say very white, he's a conservative white, I mean, culturally white as well as sort of physically white. Mm-hmm. His closest friends are all white, including Rush Limbaugh. And he's integrated about as far as possible as possible to be. I mean, what's going on in his head there? I mean, what is this? I mean, I'm trying to sort of make sense of this. I mean, and And can you, I mean, again, the book, you know, hinted at, and in, but it certainly showed the contradiction, but explaining the contradiction is the other question. I mean, what's going on? How could a man who is so totally sort of immersed in white society and culture, mm-hmm. With a legal philosophy which is about as white as you can get, I mean, make such a statement?
Well, you know, it's a statement that Clarence Thomas has made consistently, going back even to his days when he was head of civil rights at the Department of Education back in the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he first got to the court, one of the first decisions where he was applauded, maybe the only time I can think of where he was applauded by the civil rights community, was in the Fordyce case, which is a school desegregation, higher ed desegregation case that's gone on for decades in mm-hmm. Mississippi. And Thomas's position essentially was to stand up for historically black colleges and say, you know what, we don't need to worry so much about getting blacks to go to Ole Miss. Let's make the black colleges better. You know,
yeah.
The Alcorns and what have the Jackson States, and make them better and make them attractive to whites. And if whites choose to go, they should be allowed to go. But if they don't go, so what? We have our institutions. Many fine minds have been produced by them. And he's had this strain going back to even Catholic school. He still speaks longingly of his times at St. Pius X, which was an all-black high school in the Diocese of Savannah, which Clarence Thomas attended that school for 2 years before transferring to the minor seminary. And that school produced many doctors, dentists, you know, kind of the black middle class of Savannah.
Mm.
And when integration came to Savannah and it hit the diocese, guess what happened? Did they close the white school? No, they closed St. Pius, and the black students were sent to the white school. So he feels like integration has been the undoing of many black institutions. So that's part of his thinking. Now, how he reconciles that with his own personal choices in his life, that's, as you pointed out, that's still a mystery to me. That's one of the things I love to talk to him about. Because for a guy who lives, and he has some black friends, like one of his best friends is Larry Thompson, the former deputy attorney general. They go way back to St. Louis. But as you point out, much of Thomas's world is white, particularly his professional world. And it's a place where you can see him, you know, while he's loved and feted and embraced there, you can see he's a little uncomfortable, because if you read his work, particularly on race cases, you can see how consciously black he is. And this is a guy, as you pointed out earlier, when he's around the court, he, you know, just the physical court itself, and he makes a point of talking to the elevator operators, to the cafeteria workers, the shoe shine guy, the barber. I mean, he's very friendly. Beyond just sort of hello, he'll have sort of a personal word. He remembers important facts about their family, and you know, is really an easy guy. And he even has pointed out to people that he's far friendlier with these people than Thurgood Marshall ever was.
Right.
Which is an interesting point.
So is there a sense in which, is he divided at all? I mean, what, you've met him, although he refused to be interviewed. I mean, I have not. Is there a sense in which he's so self-confident and self-righteous and that he's so convinced of the rightness of his position that perhaps he isn't divided? I mean, he has he may be divided from us looking on at him and seeing the contradictions even, but that in his own person he's so convinced of the rightness of his position that he doesn't have a problem. He doesn't have a divided soul.
Well, I think the divided soul is that he wishes and he longs for a better relationship with the larger black community. He's a guy who's not post-race. I mean, he's not a guy who doesn't care. He does care about that.
But
he just doesn't know how to make the first step toward that. But as you point out, he also seems to feel that he is totally right in his philosophy and his positions. He almost views himself as kind of a guy who's making a sacrifice for the greater good of African Americans. He almost looks at it like, you know, people don't get it now, but they'll get it later. And I'm going to walk this walk, and I'll take the burden and do this, because this is what we need to do as a people.
I see. Let me ask you one thing. Do you think, to what extent, and perhaps the book might have explored more, the extent to which Thomas' own contradictions reflect broader contradictions in the black communities, or should I say communities themselves, in that let's take this thing of integration.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent people are expressing shock at the Supreme Court, but in fact a substantial number of blacks have seemed to me have given up if not intellectually, certainly in terms of their personal lives, I mean, some of where they live and so on integration. The Prince George's County, as you know, I mean, years ago, has made their peace with this and could be claiming that they don't mind having a segregated system as long as they get their share of tax revenues. And one of the things, as I've tried to argue in my columns in the Times and elsewhere, the most distressing failure, as far as I'm concerned, of the civil rights agenda is the failure of integration. Mm-hmm. And part of that failure has to do with the fact that even the current black middle class remains very, very segregated. So there is a sense in which Thomas's apparent contradiction is partly a reflection of a broader contradiction, because, you know, I mean, the NAACP is expressing horror and so on at the Supreme Court decision, but it may well be pointed out that, look, given black actual sort of behavior and experience and where they live and the continuing pattern of segregation, which is partly white imposed, but also it seems increasingly a matter of black preference. I mean, can we say that this is a contradiction which is peculiar to Thomas?
No, I mean, I think you make a very, very astute point there. I mean, if you look at not just PG County, but you go to parts of Atlanta, increasingly, and even with an NAACP, the very model of integrationist thinking, mm-hmm. there's been a debate about, you know, how far should we push this this integration agenda, and should we be a little more nationalistic in a sense? Should we be more concerned about building our institution or rebuilding our institutions? And I think you're right, even though I think Thomas takes it farther than a lot of African Americans would want to go, because he would extend it into, you know, if you talk about these magnet school programs, you talk about certain school, you know, public school programs, many black middle class people have taken great advantage of those kinds of things. And if you extend it into the higher education realm, you know, Clarence Thomas dismisses it as, you know, elites, you know, doing their social engineering. But for many African Americans, hey, this is a leg up, this is a way up. And for Clarence Thomas himself, his own biography shows you the value of that and the power of that and the ability of those programs to lift you up.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. There's a little bit of a, you know, dichotomy there. African Americans, you know, we sort of, to some extent, want it both ways. You know, we want our own institutions, but we want that path to integration to remain open.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's it.
Well, it's something we'll have to resolve, I mean, sooner or later. But let me ask you one other thing having to do with the hearings themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I thought perhaps, you know, I mean, it seems to me that this was a disaster for liberals. I mean, becoming more so as the guy has shown himself to be the most conservative of the justices. And I would have preferred a deeper look at that strategic mistake. Because, you know, one of the extraordinary things you pointed out is that the most notorious screed in the whole episode was this high-tech lynching, and the fact that it didn't originate with Thomas, but from a Republican strategist who clearly knew his racial history more than the liberals did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it struck me then in the op-ed I wrote and got berated for, as it still strikes me now, that it was a strategic blunder going after the man's sexuality. You know, I mean, on national TV and so on, given America's racial past. And, I mean, I felt you could have been a bit more critical, or at least gone more in depth in the manipulative nature of the thing, and in fact, at both sides, I mean, erred, although, well, the right one. But, you know, as you yourself noted, that high-tech metaphor turned the tide for one or two senators who got so sort of, intimidated by the possible view that they're being a racist, that they voted in a way which, I mean, 10 months later, they regretted.
They came to regret.
And,
you're right.
You know,
I mean, this whole thing.
I would have preferred a deeper look at the mistake which was made there. I felt it was a mistake at the time, and I still do, going after a black man's sort of sexual sort of you know, behavior. I mean, don't you think that was a serious blunder?
Yeah, it was a mistake, but I think they were kind of, the way it sort of all transpired, I think the Judiciary Committee sort of had no choice. Because remember, this was the second phase of hearings. I think they blundered on the first half of the hearings, and the right was masterful, and that's where the pinpoint myth thing comes in.
Right.
When Clarence Thomas was nominated, they told this story of this guy, and you're absolutely right. He has a tremendous story. There's no question about it, but they even exaggerated that tremendous story.
Right.
And civil rights groups made a mistake because they saw a black man, and they knew his record, and they knew he had, by that point, become kind of a dyed-in-the-wool conservative.
Right.
But somehow, you know, you heard this kind of talk in the community that, oh, this is a black man. His story is so familiar. His narrative is a familiar one, that once he has the security of tenure on this world's, you know, most powerful court, he will, quote-unquote, do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he will, quote-unquote, recognize that he's a black man, as if there's
right.
only one way to do that. And that was a mistake, you know, and they didn't oppose Clarence Thomas from the liberals' point of view. And they didn't, the NAACP took a month to come out against Clarence Thomas, but at that point, the pinpoint story had taken hold. And Clarence Thomas went through his hearings, and they were contentious. There was a lot of talk about natural law and whether or not Thomas agreed with that. But he got through those hearings. He was going to be confirmed. And as you remember, the Anita Hill story was leaked to National
right.
Public Radio
that,
and Newsday,
yeah.
causing
right.
a second round of hearings. And the Judiciary Committee did not really want that
right.
responsibility because they mishandled the hearings, as you recall. There were people who could have corroborated Anita Hill's story.
Right.
Who weren't called because they were reluctant. They didn't know what to do. As you point out, this was too hot for them to handle.
Right.
Here you have this panel of white men dealing with, you know, issue of sexuality. With, you know,
right.
On top of that,
right.
with black folks, it was just too
exactly,
much.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. I found it intriguing. You know, what I've always thought, and I still do, and some of the things you wrote suggest to me that, I mean, I'm even right. I thought it interesting that you found that Anita Hill's own some of her closest relatives think that something happened, but that, in a way,
mm-hmm.
both were out of strong reasons to deny that anything happened.
Exactly.
That was a funny situation. Let me ask you one other question. I mean, is there any positives at all for blacks in Thomas's situation as one of the most powerful men in America? I mean. He's going to be with us for another 30 years or more.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Is there a sense in which having a black person as conservative as that makes it clear to the world that, you know, you cannot stereotype, you cannot, assume that being black means X, Y, Z, usually at the far left of the Democratic Party, and that this may well have a salutary effect, at least on the more conservative members of our society. Is there anything positive in that? And there's a sense also for black Americans that you cannot assume that because someone is black they're going to, act in racially, conscious or ways that promote black interests, that you just have to see this person as, well, a conservative, period. And that maybe I'm grasping for the positive here, but that there may be something of benefit in that.
Yeah, I think the second part is probably what I can see. I mean, where African Americans have to, first we have to accept the fact that Justice Thomas is an individual. You know, I mean, it sort of gets you out of this kind of groupthink, like, you know, because he's a black man, X should follow or Y should follow.
Right.
I mean, there's no telling what will follow just because someone's a black man. You need to look at, more things about that person. Being black is not all defining. You know, it's one thing about a person, and clearly racial identity is important to Justice Thomas, but he happens to have
right.
a different path than maybe, than clearly most African Americans
right.
do, and perhaps different than you or I. And that's, I mean, he's entitled to that. And I think African Americans need to learn that,
right.
not everyone in leadership is going to
right.
lead the way that you would have them lead. You
right.
know?
And let's flip this around to the other side of the spectrum. Is there a sense in which Barack Obama is indeed, you know, on the left, in a similar kind of, facing a similar kind of dilemma and how to finesse that. That it's also the same issue. He faces a problem in a way that it's assumed that if you're black, you have to be the black candidate. And in one sense, he's struggling hard, although he has to be very, very careful to avoid that pigeonholing.
Yeah, you know, you could see him walking the tightrope. I remember I was covering Barack Obama a couple of months ago down at a dinner in South Carolina for the South Carolina Legislative Black Caucus. It was their annual fundraising dinner. And, you know, you can feel the anticipation in the room when Barack was coming out to speak. And, you know, Senator Obama came, and you could just almost see him consciously not going for the applause lines, not going for kind of the fiery rhetoric, almost coming in a little bit under expectation and trying to be reflective, trying to get people to think, and also throwing out things that a white candidate couldn't throw out. And that's the speech where he talked about, you know, African Americans need, you know, we need to come home, and same things Clarence Thomas would agree with, that we need to, you know, turn off the TV set when the kids are doing the homework. We need to pick up, you know, in the neighborhood, sweep up, clean up. That would help economic development as much as anything. You know, and making all of those points, and of course making other points too about how schools need more funding. Maybe Clarence Thomas might not say that.
Right.
You can see him, you know, you can see him kind of straddling the situation. And even recently during a debate here at Howard University in Washington, I read an op-ed in our paper, the Washington Post, where someone was kind of criticizing Senator Obama, but winking at him at the same time, saying, well, he couldn't really speak to black issues, you know, because, but you know what, maybe he's saying exactly what he wants to say, and you know, people might want to consider that.
Right, or maybe it's something else, that in fact, what the era of targeted black sort of politics, and maybe not at an end, but perhaps for the benefit of blacks themselves, we need to move towards a more universalist strategy in which one emphasizes those aspects of American life which, by promoting them, will promote black interests. So, for example, you know, instead of having a policy for black poverty, one has a policy which is aimed at removing all poverty, and for whites and blacks, and that, I mean, such a strategy may well sell better in the long run, and maybe well in the interest of black people, and that we're at that turning point now where perhaps we've exhausted the targeted approach, a sort of black interest being sort of in some sense fundamentally different from the interests of, say, the white poor, and it's in a way Thomas is on the conservative side in his claim to be sort of speaking a kind of universalist, I mean rationalist legal philosophy, which, you know, I mean, I entirely disagree with, but nonetheless this is his intent, is striving for something like that, as and when he claims that what he's doing is on behalf of blacks, whether they know it or not, mm-hmm. is similar in a way to someone who's going to say, look, I'm going to move away from, you know, ghetto development and so on, towards emphasizing, as Barack Obama does, more universalist strategy. It's best to sort of promote the welfare state for everyone, universal health coverage, rather than health for blacks or social problems. You know, that maybe we are at a turning point where we need to think more in those terms.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we have to look any farther than sort of demographic trends to recognize the need for some change in strategy. You know, African Americans are obviously not even any longer the largest minority in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you look within the African American community, many people have made the move to the middle class, and you know, middle-class people, while they may be a paycheck or two away from not being middle-class, have different concerns mm-hmm. than the poor and all of that. And like you said, their concerns become more like other middle-class people. Mm-hmm. You know, how am I going to pay the college tuition? Should I be protesting the state tuition increase? Should that, you know, not be in place? You know, I mean, you know, things that don't have a racial label but have a racial impact.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed reading your book very, very much, and I think it's a wonderful biography, and I certainly hope that as many people as possible enjoy it as much as I did.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Patterson. Thanks for the review, and thanks for doing the interview.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.